Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I was so involved in preparing for this show, I almost forgot to show up. Anyway, I think I'll start out the show with a very, very interesting clip about the constellation of Orion. Now, we're going to talk about the Great Pyramid today. We're going to talk about one of Billy's contacts, a woman named Asket. And I thought this clip was appropriate to kind of set the stage, if you will. So let's start out with this little bit on the constellation of Orion, and then we'll be back. This is about a 3-minute clip.
If you're interested in astronomy, winter can provide some of the best opportunities for finding and viewing objects in space. Some constellations are only visible during the winter months. The cold, clear night skies of winter provide some of the best opportunities for observing space. Look south on a clear winter night, and you will see 3 bright stars aligned in a row. These stars are Orion's Belt, located at the center of the ancient constellation Orion, the Hunter. The upper left star in Orion is Betelgeuse, a red giant star so large that if it were our sun, it would consume the Earth. The bright blue star Rigel marks the lower right of the constellation. Rigel is a rare, super-hot blue giant star. It is located 776 light-years from Earth. Light, traveling at the incredible speed of 300,000 kilometers per second, takes 776 years to complete the journey from Rigel to Earth. If you go out and look at Rigel tonight, the light that enters your eye has been traveling through space for 776 years. When you look deep into space, you are looking back in time. Sirius, the brightest star in the sky after our sun, sits beside Orion. Sirius is very close. It is 9 light years from Earth. Hanging below Orion's belt is a linear pattern of stars that hold a stellar nursery, a place where new stars are being born. Astronomers call this glowing cloud a nebula. It has the designation M42. 1,500 light years away, M42 is a vast cloud of interstellar dust and gas. Pockets of gravity pull the dust and gas into dense spheres of matter. Under incredible pressure, nuclear fusion starts and the new stars spring to life. M42 is easily seen as a small nebula, like a thin glowing cloud. Binoculars are all you need to see this interesting deep space object. Orion disappears in the summer. It is hidden by the glow of the sun. The Hunter will return again in the fall.
The Great Pyramid of Giza is the oldest and largest of the 3 pyramids in the Giza necropolis. The pyramids were built for various reasons, or they serve various purposes, and we'll discuss those in a minute. I'm still researching, some of that information as well. In a FIGU bulletin, FIGU bulletin 11, there's an excerpt that I think is taken from Contact 256, where Billy was speaking with Ta, I believe, and he asked him certain questions about the pyramids, and Billy basically said, I would like to ask you something about the Great Pyramids, which are not only found in Egypt, but all over the globe. Asket had told Billy before that the pyramids were constructed under the direction of extraterrestrials. In fact, they were. And these extraterrestrials came from the Orion constellation. Orion is a constellation that's located in what they call the celestial equator. And the celestial equator is a great circle, kind of an imaginary sphere, around the Earth's equator. And Orion, the Orion constellation, can be seen throughout the world. It's one of the most conspicuous and recognizable constellations in the night sky. It has about 8 stars that are fairly close, 32 light years away. The earliest depiction of this constellation is about 32,000 to 38,000 years old. And the star pattern that was named after Orion, Orion basically is a hunter in Greek mythology. And he was this giant huntsman that Zeus was said to place among the stars in the constellation of Orion. Now, in ancient Egypt, the stars of Orion were regarded as a god called Sa. And let me give you, this is an incomplete set of characteristics on the Great Pyramid, but I'll throw these at you quickly. First of all, the height. Currently, the Great Pyramid is 481 feet tall. However, the Meyer material says that at one time it was 152.5 meters high, which is about 500 feet. So somehow the Great Pyramid lost a little height. And I think that might have been because over time they've scraped some limestone off of it. The reason it was built 152.5 meters in height is because there was 1 meter for each part of the height of the Great Pyramid corresponded to 1 million kilometers in distance from the sun. So it was, the height of the Great Pyramid was constructed, so it was in proportional ratio to the distance to the sun. And what was the extraterrestrial involvement? Well, there were extraterrestrials from the Orion constellation that directed the building of the Great Pyramid. And I also think that there was, at a later time, maybe some extraterrestrials from either Leo or another constellation that were here. What is the construction date? Well, the Meyer material says the pyramids across the world were built about 36,650 years ago, one group, and another group about 73,300 years ago. So the Great Pyramid was built about 73,000 years ago. Our scientists say it was built at 2,560 BC, which is about 4,500 years ago. So there's obviously a discrepancy there. Some of the uses of the Great Pyramid, King Seleuk, there was a king, King Seleuk, this is around 9,500 BC, because of the visions of his son Sarad, they used the Great Pyramid as a refuge. They basically coated it with lime, made it watertight. They stored a bunch of food and water within the Great Pyramid and in these cubicle constructions far below the pyramid, and they survived this great flood, which occurred about 9,500 years ago when the Destroyer Comet came through. Now, the pyramids were used as tombs later, about 2,000 years ago. At the beginning of the show, I played a quick clip that introduces the constellation of Orion, something called M42. The Orion Nebula is part of the constellation of Orion. The constellation of Orion is huge, and it has like 100 different stars in it. Some of the interesting stars are called Betelgeuse, Rigel, the Cirrus star. And I want to play a clip that Nassim Haramein did on the pyramids and Orion's belt. Nassim Haramein was born in Geneva, Switzerland in 1962. As early as 9 years old, Nassim was already developing the basis for what he called his unified hyperdimensional theory of matter and energy, which he eventually called the holofractographic universe. So if I can find this clip, I'll play that, and then I'll bring some callers online and we can chat a little bit about this. Let's hope that I can find, you know, that's the problem when you make a lot of clips. Sometimes they can be rather challenging to find. So bear with me just a second here. This is quite an interesting lecture by Nassim. I'm getting too many clips, I think. Okay, let's play the first one here. The Pyramids and the Orion's Belt by Nassim Haramein.
Come to this geometric structure. Well, if you study the Egyptians, the Mayans, the Incas, all these people, the Indians, you know, all these people, they all did this crazy geometry thing. And they talked about it in various ways. But what is most impressive is that they left very tangible things out there that had to do with geometry. And the things they left out there, if they were little models, you know, 3 feet high, with, you know, easy to build, you'd say, well, you know, they must have instinctively figured this out, right? But if they leave behind something like this, it brings a whole new set of questions to the forefront. And that is, how were they able to pull this off? Okay? Listen, I know that you've heard a lot of stories from your schooling about how pyramids were built. And I know that they told you mostly that these pyramids were built in a very specific way, and that's a fact. That is, between, depending on the theory, 20,000 to 100,000 slaves or farmers that during the Nile flooding every year would go and build pyramids. And they built them, in, depending on the series, between 20 and 40 years, you know, period, and all this. And that's all nice and dandy, and you have to realize that they teach this as fact. For instance, when you read in those books, it says, well, the pyramids were built by, not may have built by, nothing like that. It's like fact. And you think, well, that must be it, right? But when you think about it, those people that are writing these facts are not engineers. They're not physicists. They don't necessarily understand what it takes to build things. They don't necessarily understand how difficult it is to get great precision from building with stone. They don't necessarily understand that copper doesn't cut stone. And that so far, copper hasn't been found to be able to be hardened to cut stone, and so on. So they just throw this stuff out there, and because they have PhDs and they're in the 1800s and they can't imagine of anything else, then everybody goes with that. And I assure you, if you're doing a PhD in Egyptology or in antiquity, in ancient civilization studies or so on, and you right the thesis that these were built in any other way, you're probably not going to get your PhD. And so I was really kind of stunned because I started to study it, because to me, I had solved a lot of these issues, but there was something that just kept on nagging at me. It's like, maybe the history of the earth, maybe the history of our civilization is quite different than what we think it is. And if that's true, I want to know why. Because then I could modify my view of evolution to match the true reality of what happened out there, and that could change a lot of things in the way I think of myself and my ancestors and the way things have been done and my place in the universe. So I started to study these things, and I tell you, when you start studying these things, just a little, and I'm in contact with a lot of physicists, so if I can't run the math, I can ask people their opinion and so on. And when you study these things just a little, right away, you're confronted with amazing, amazing data. For instance, the Grand Pyramid of Giza is 481 feet tall. It's built out of 2,300,000 stones in average, you know, approximately. And the base of the pyramid is 13 acres square. Okay? When they place the last stone on...
Okay. Amazing stuff. Let me bring Nate on. Nate, how are you this afternoon?
Good. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I'll see if Eve is just listening or she wants to talk. Eve, are you participating this afternoon or just listening?
Well, I'll hang in there and see.
Okay.
Yeah. Keep me on.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you. As I was saying in the chat room, looks like all my Facebook notifications, all my BTR notifications failed. I'm getting a little background noise from somewhere. Just to
let me mute my phone and see if it's me.
Somebody's chopping wood. I don't know. Anyway.
So the Great Pyramids were allegedly built by people from Orion?
No, they were built under direction. The building was directed. Let me try something here just a second. I just wanted to see where that noise was coming from. I was, not sure still. Yeah, it was evidently, and this is part of the, you know, when the Meyer material says it was built by Earth humans, actually, under the direction of people from Orion. That's really kind of general. Wow, we're getting all kinds of, can you guys hear that?
No.
Was that a no or a yes?
I can. Sounds like Nate's kind of out of sync somewhere along the line here.
Is it? Okay. Let me mute Nate just for a second. We'll find out. Okay. There we're muting. No, I'm still hearing it.
I don't hear it.
You don't hear it at all?
No.
Okay, let me mute you. Okay, now we've got both of you muted. And we sound great. Okay, let me bring Nate back on. Okay, Nate.
Hi.
You sound pretty good. So, Eva, I'm going to keep you muted just for a little while, and we'll see if, I don't know, you know, who knows, man, this stuff is so weird. Sometimes. But Eve was asking who built the pyramids, and there were some 200,000 Earth humans involved with the construction, but it was directed by a group of extraterrestrials from Orion, and of course the problem with, you know, Orion is vast. It's just a constellation of incredible size. If you look at Orion's belt, and I think in some way the three pyramids there in Egypt line up to these stars. And sometimes the Orion's belt is known as the three kings or the three sisters. And the stars consist of these three bright stars, Al-Nitak, Al-Lam, Mintaka. I don't know where they got those names. All these stars are between 700 and 1,000 light years from Earth. So, wow. Now, there are some 30, I think it was eight stars that are some within 32 light years of Earth. Either way, the extraterrestrials who came here came a hell of a distance. And why they were here, I'm not sure. But my understanding was they were here during the times of Atlantis and Lemuria, and the time of Atlantis and Lemuria began about 133,000 years ago and ended about 11,500 years ago. Does that correspond to your knowledge, Nate?
I have no idea. I just went blank. All I know is Atlantis, you know, was in a peaceful state, and they had come from a warlike system, and they had almost 2,000 years of peace before the progenitors of the Giza intelligences got a hold and sowed intrigue, and then they had the Great War that brought down the meteor and stuff. So,
right.
But under the direction of extraterrestrial, or with help from the extraterrestrial. What was interesting is it's been sold to us our whole life that there was a lot of slaves that worked on the pyramids, and this was not actually the case. A lot of them were day laborers. And I guess, do you remember who was the seer? There was someone who, the son of the king at that time, was a seer, and he could see into the future, and this is why they started the construction of the pyramids.
Right. I probably said that before you called in, but there's a king, Saluk, who had a son named Sarid, who saw this great flood around 9500 BC, and that's when the Destroyer Comet came through. So they... And they took three centuries to stock up food below the Great Pyramid and water. And then they coated the Great Pyramid with limestone to make it watertight. And then they hid within the Great Pyramid. And if they hadn't have done that, it may have wiped out all of humanity, as a matter of fact. So that was one of the uses. Now, not necessarily the purpose. From what I understand, the purpose has been kind of intentionally hidden from us. Does that correspond to your knowledge, Nate?
The purpose of the pyramids themselves?
Yes, the purpose.
I think there was a lot of things constructed into the pyramids, but how I always understood it was that during different epochs and different timelines, the pyramids were used in different ways.
Right.
When you say they were coded...
I'm not talking about the uses. I'm talking about the purpose. Because like I just said, they were utilized as pyramids, or as tombs, about 2,000 years ago. They were used as a refuge in 9500 BC. But I think the original purpose has been withheld from us.
Withheld or were they, because they found cities underneath the pyramid and stuff like that, or what do you mean withheld? Who's withholding it?
Well, in other words, it was one of the things that the Plaiaran wouldn't tell Billy for various reasons.
Oh, okay, yeah. So in contact report, I think it's 127. They go over basically Guido came up with certain measurements of the pyramid. And Billy was asking Tamiazi if they correspond to it, and they were talking about the speed, the actual exact speed of light was sevenfold the height of the pyramid or something in calculation. And then Tamiazi goes off and says, hey, you know what, you got to stop mentioning any of this because this will give insights before they're ready to have these types of insights, and it will cause a disruption in your evolution timeline.
Isn't that so interesting, the way that certain information has to be kind of withheld from us? Because if we get a hold of certain information too soon, we'll self-destruct with it.
Yeah, that is. That makes sense, though, because there's a lot of crazies here.
So, you know, it probably wouldn't have been good for extraterrestrials to give us the knowledge to split the atom, you know, maybe two centuries ago. That probably would have been bad too. You know, certain knowledge, you have to have a certain level of responsibility to use certain knowledge. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, definitely. We're oftentimes on the edge of that responsibility. I mean, some of the things that we've come up with, like when they discovered there was a hole in the ozone layer and that there could actually be a hole in the ozone layer, one of the first things the scientists went about doing was creating a ozone layer bomb. This was in the middle of the Cold War, or a missile, whatever, and they're going to ignite it over Russia and put a ozone layer above that country and burn all the people there. Just like, what? Just the insanity of...
That's so insane. Do you know, this sounds like an exaggeration, but I'm pretty sure that it isn't. I think we've blown up 2,000 nuclear bombs in testing.
Actually, there's a beautiful video done, and it's a timeline of nuclear detonations around the world since the since its discovery. And if I can find that, I'll put it up for you in the in the room.
Now, do you remember? I tell this story all the time. I think Billy was 16 years old. He was told to go up on this hill, and he would be picked up by this robotic craft, which landed, door open, he got into it. And this robotic craft took him first to Jordan. He got out of the craft. He recognized where he was, felt the heat, saw the red rocks. And then out of the sky, Asket's ship came. It looked like a falling star. He followed her into the ship. Then they went to Egypt. She put that little device on his belt that allowed him to be invisible. She made herself also invisible. They went far below the Giza Plateau into these old cubicle constructions that were some 73,000 years old. And Billy went into this incredible hallway where the light seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere. And that's where he saw this ancient spacecraft, and he saw these artifacts, and he saw guards too. And in Asket's explanations in line 182, it says, in the Pyramid of Giza, I well noticed your thoughts and searched closer and thereby established that to a certain degree, you are still doubtful regarding the wrongness and false teaching of the religion. So Billy had kind of, a cognitive dissonance originally. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, actually, that helped me out when I had gone through certain things. And, you know, I've had my experiences where I felt like, I don't know, anxiety, if you will, or fearful of certain things that were just so far embedded down into me from when I was little, from society, or just, you know, indirectly or directly. And it's you think you might have gotten away from a lot of the stuff, but sometimes when certain things like show their head,
mm-hmm.
Then you're kind of like, uh-oh. Like, I remember, for example, watching some atheist guy, and he was in this church, and he says, Well, he was talking about unforgivable sins, and one of the unforgivable sins is blasphemy of the Holy Spirit or something. And basically he said, you know, the Holy Spirit doesn't exist or something. And I remember it caused like a jerk or a fear in me. I'm like, what the heck did that come from, you know? Me thinking really pragmatic or whatnot. But, yeah, there's some still stuff. And this part ask his explanation, you know, it helped me out on an individual level, but, you know, it also helped out Billy at that time because, you know, he had come up in a very religious, you know, on how can you not but try as you might not trust people around you and stuff, and they keep everybody doing their thing, but at the same time they're selling this religion in you, and you're just like, oh, okay.
Well, what's interesting is this Giza intelligence group that resided far below the Giza Plateau, they use something called telenotic impulses to influence the people of the Earth. And what they really wanted to do was control the people of the Earth through religion. They also had interaction with Hitler and through the Thule Society. So they've been influencing us for thousands of years, and I think it's Contact Report 70 that gives the whole lineage of the Giza intelligences, starting with Eris the 11th and going to Jehovan, Jehave, Erisame, the man named Hen, who is also known as Jehovah, and then Kamigal the first, Kamigal the second. These extraterrestrials, according to the Meyer material, anyway, were below the Giza Plateau all the way up into the 1970s, somehow still broadcasting these telenotic impulses and trying to control the people of the Earth. That's just an amazing story to me. What were your thoughts when you first came across that information, Nate?
I was thinking, thank goodness for the Playorans and taking responsibility, and thank goodness for Billy at that time, because without them, I don't know if you remember where they were talking about how they went to, they were following certain ships, and they went off to the distant star systems and stuff, and they found several technological devices that were flooding us with a frequency that would tune our vibrational frequency to that of a believer, or belief. So they were flooding our planet with an artificial belief, like they had discovered how to use, or discovered that when people believe, they let off a certain impulse and stuff. So to snuff out our evolutionary potential and whatnot, and to combat, you know, a natural law, they were doing this, which was simply amazing, because there's no way, you know, we don't stand a chance when that's over us. You know, it's just nothing we can do. We can't get out to that distant star where they're beaming this energy at us, and, you know, talk about, you know, and they talked about the bell-shaped energy and stuff that kind of surrounds the planet. You know, you remember that?
Vaguely. When you were describing that, what it made me think of was the Inquisition. And as I was saying on the last show, when Billy, it's up on the Future Mankind site, and you can read it. It's called The Introduction to the Talmud of Emmanuel. He described that actually during the Spanish Inquisition, I think it was 18 million people were killed, 9 million people initially, and then another 9 million later. I mean, that is just a statistic that's really incredible. That you know, that's the abuse of religion and the abuse of the death penalty. But even though all these horrendous crimes have been committed by all these religious groups, we still, like you said, have this belief thing. You know what I'm saying? That somehow that those religions are a true authority.
Yeah. And well, it's powered oftentimes through media and stuff. I mean, I remember seeing videos and stuff when I was little and movies, and they would always, like, belief was like, da-da-da-da. As long as you have, it doesn't matter what you believe in, as long as you have belief. It's just like, well. and they would use it as like this rod of power in these movies and stuff, and you're just like, huh? Oh, I believe I can do it. I believe I can do it, you know, and they've sewn that into everything. You see it if you watch cartoons and stuff, you see it going away. They sow self-responsibility and growth and realism in cartoons more so than a lot of the adult entertainment out there.
Are they creating positive cartoons now for kids?
Yeah. There's a movie called The Box Trolls. So if you go and you check out that movie, The Box Trolls, I think it's just laden with awesome undertones. I mean, kids are watching it, but if you're an adult and you're watching, and if you're a thinking adult and you're watching, it's just amazing.
Interesting. I'm going to play our next clip here. This is Nassim Haramein again, talking about the Great Pyramid. So I think this is great stuff.
Pyramid of Giza, which we don't have at this point. You see, the stone on the Grand Pyramid of Giza were ripped out. See, there was a covering on the stones all over the pyramid that was mined to build Cairo in the early 1900s and late 1800s. And so these stones were extremely perfect. The pyramids was much more perfect before. But still to this day, when you look at the immensity of the building and then you get satellite mapping of the apex of the pyramid, the apex is a quarter of an inch off the center of a 13-acre square base. I don't know if we have builders in the crew here today, but I guarantee you this type of achievement, after having placed 2,300,000 stones, is not anything any engineering firm with all of the money in the world and the technology we have is able to reproduce today. I assure you, we cannot do that. We cannot reproduce that. You have to divide a quarter of an inch by 2,300,000 stones to be able to get the accuracy of the placement of the stone. It's a very amazing thing. And then by the time they were done, the orientation of the pyramid to the stellar pole and so on, the way the pyramid is oriented and so on, is extremely accurate. More accurate than many of our current buildings, including telescopes and such. The size, the enormous size of the building is beyond any comprehension. And there's another issue that's very, very dramatic. There is blocks in the Grand Pyramid, in the King's Chamber. There's 100 blocks of granite that have been hoisted to up to 130 feet of elevation in the Grand Pyramid and placed in perfect accuracy to create a relief of the pressure of the stones above with very amazing engineering so that the whole thing holds together in a way that that is unmatchable with all of our technology today. There's another problem, okay, in archaeology here. Archaeology is really the art of decoding text, decoding the remains of a civilization, and from these decoding, extrapolating their morals, their behavior, their day-to-day life, and so on. Well, if you follow that path, you would expect that somewhere in Egypt, after having placed thousands and thousands and thousands of hieroglyphs in all the temples and tombs and everywhere, okay, telling us everything about the behaviors of their Morses, like what they ate, how they went to the washroom, what they did and how they did it and everything. I mean, they tell us everything, how they made love and everything, right? That somewhere somebody would have mentioned, oh, by the way, we built the pyramids too. Don't you think? I mean, you'd expect that, right? But not one wall says that. Nothing in Egypt says we built the pyramids. Nothing in Mayan country says we built the pyramids. Nothing in Inca tradition says we built the pyramid. You know how they tell you that the pyramids were built as tombs. And these tombs were there to have the pharaoh be buried into, right? You've all heard that. And you would expect that the reason they're telling you that is that they found...
Anyway, I love Nassim Haramein. I love when he talks about the Great Pyramid. I love when he was discussing those 100 blocks of granite. I think it's for the King's Chamber that were lifted up some 130 feet, and they were used to kind of support some of the tremendous weight of the other stones. And you know, Nate, he made a pretty good point there that you would think that the Egyptians would have talked more about building the pyramids, but evidently the hieroglyphs never said that. So there's much to learn still about this whole pyramid issue. I think it's very fascinating indeed. But anyway, onward and upward here. I think the Great Pyramid is truly one of the fascinating things in the Meyer material, because you get insight that you don't really get anywhere else when it comes to this information. You know, it's very interesting. Giorgio Tsoukalos, who was a guest on Coast to Coast in 2011, I remember this interview. Giorgio Tsoukalos said, there is an ancient manuscript in Egypt called Al-Hittat that says the pyramids were built by the Egyptians with the assistance of the guardians of the sky, or the watchers who came from heaven, you know. Very interesting. So these extraterrestrials from Orion that were here, evidently during the times of Atlantis and Lemuria, are talked about in this ancient manuscript. And I think there are other things that have been hidden in one of Colonel Wendell Stevens' books that I have. He talks about, in one of the pyramids, maybe Cheops Pyramid, there was a mural made. It's something that's not opened up to the public, but there's a mural in there of a cigar-shaped craft floating over the Great Pyramids there. More evidence of extraterrestrial intervention. It's also interesting that Nassim says it's hard to explain the building of the pyramids using vine ropes, copper tools, no pulley, and so on, and that there are 2,300,000 stones in the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid stands about 481 feet in altitude, and that apex of the Great Pyramid is only a quarter of an inch off the center. The base is 13 acres. So the tremendous construction techniques that were used in the Great Pyramid. And during the time that it was says it was built, about 2500 BC, that was before the Iron Age. In this time, in our time that we live now, the Iron Age began around 1200 BC. So at that time, the people, again, who were climbing out of the rubble of the destruction of Atlantis and Lemuria hadn't reinvented iron yet. These people only had soft metals like bronze and copper. Some of the other fantastic constructions in Egypt are the Colossi of Memnon, where two massive statues, 60 feet high, they weigh an estimated 720 tons apiece. That's about 1,440,000 pounds. These statues were transported 420 miles. There's another statue called the Colossal Statue of Ramses II, which weighs some 83 tons. And Nassim, later on in this same presentation, talks about a statue that they found somewhere in the desert that had just fallen over. It was some 300 tons, or made of a 300-ton stone. Outside the Sphinx, you can tell these stones were moved away from the Sphinx and piled up, stones that weigh 200 tons. So somebody could move some really massive things around. Nader, are you still with us?
Yes.
Some of that, it's pretty amazing, you know, that the size of these stones and the way they were moved around so easily.
Well, there's a place called Baalbek.
Yes.
Something like that. They got these ginormous stones, and they have these pictures of people standing on these stones, but these stones form the base of the old city that they had built there, and it shows. And one of these things I remember, it was showing like who did what. So, you know, I guess I don't know if it was the Sumerians that did this, the base, and then it was abandoned and rebuilt by another culture, and then once again it was abandoned and rebuilt by I think finally the Romans settled it. But there's some amazing pictures at the stones of Baalbek about how big these stones got that they were moving around. If you get a chance, check that out. And also, I don't know. This might be just complete speculation or whatnot. I had heard stuff about the pyramids being some sort of energy generator or energy power generator.
Right.
And a pyramid in two-dimensional space is also a triangle. And from the Mayan material, we know that the Bermuda Triangle was actually a portal. Essentially a portal or a wormhole at a specific time because of some sort of outer space alignment with different stars and whatnot, and it created an energy lens of some sort where ships could travel to and for that. And then we have this giant ship. In Asa's explanation, I was talking when they went down underneath the pyramids and they saw the Giza intelligence, they saw this giant ship. But my question is, you know, how long has it been there? Has it always been there? Did they have the technology to transport through solid matter, or were there some crazy back way out of it? But there's also, along this line of thinking, perhaps they used the pyramids themselves at one time to transport from Orion's constellation to here, or to be able to transport here and there in case things became too hairy-carry. And I don't know, it's fun to think about those things. So there's no merit to that, but just a...
I think it's fascinating and good speculation. I find it fascinating. And you might have something there. That's very interesting. I think what I'm going to do is kind of get us back on track a little bit with the earlier two previous shows where we've been talking about overpopulation and the destruction of our culture, how we're a culture in decline, how our empire seems to be ending. So probably what I'll do is play about 8 minutes or so of a clip from that very interesting movie called Life at the End of the Empire. So let's listen here It's sobering stuff. So hopefully we're not going to be ending this empire the way Atlantis and Lemuria did.
It takes a long time.
Peak oil got my attention. The ramifications are enormous. And if the oil situation is bleak, some say that the natural gas situation is even worse. As writer and professor Otis Graham said,
we've had 300 or 400 years of fossil fuel. It's coming to an end. Is that an historic turning point? It's breathtaking.
Even more breathtaking is what happens when we burn this stuff. Scientists used to talk about climate change in terms of centuries. Now they're talking about decades. Now they're talking about next year. Now they're talking about now. My friends and neighbors are talking about it too.
We've increased the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere,
which traps heat in the Earth's atmosphere, which raises the temperature.
The glaciers are melting, the sea ice is melting. You know, the polar ice caps are basically melting.
And I hate it. I hate feeling like we've done this to nature, and not to mention all of the animals, all of the wildlife that are going to die.
It'll begin to happen. It's already beginning to happen. It's happening everywhere. You know, it's happening.
It's terrifying.
It's a drag.
That's putting it mildly. The only good thing I can think to say about climate change is that when I understood the climate situation, I spent less time worrying about oil.
Some people have said, and I think they're right about this, we're going to run out of air to burn before we run out of fossil fuels to burn. In other words, the fossil fuels are creating the global warming problem, the CO2, and the pollution problems. And if we keep using those, it's not really a matter of when we run out of fossil fuels. It's when we befoul the atmosphere so much and create so much global warming, it's irrelevant how much gas we've got left.
There, see what I mean? You feel better already, don't you? So whom else could I speak with about the climate? Turns out I didn't have to go very far. William Schlesinger, dean of the Nicholas School of the Environment and Earth Sciences at Duke University, had this to say.
We have raised around, globally in our atmosphere the concentration of carbon dioxide from about 280 parts per million in the late 1800s to close to 380 parts per million today. That's a roughly a 30% increase.
And the projection is it will be 550, 560 in the year 2050.
Schlesinger's colleague at Duke, Professor of Conservation Ecology Stuart Pym, added this.
There is now a strong scientific consensus that that has caused warming over the last several decades, maybe centuries. And there's a strong expectation that it will continue to do so.
So, greenhouse gases on the rise, temperature on the rise, more floods, more droughts, rising sea level. It's been in the news for some time now. How does this impact the community of life?
Birds are arriving earlier in the springtime. Plants are flowering earlier. Species ranges are moving northward. We are seeing an extraordinarily strong signal, biological signal, of what global warming is doing to us.
Crops and trees will grow in places they don't grow today. We have a lot of suspicion that they may not grow as well.
And we're beginning to see extinctions of species that have literally no place else to go as the climate gets warmer.
There's one impact I found particularly sobering.
The carbon in the atmosphere goes into the ocean. I guess absorbed in the ocean is, I want to say, carbonic acid.
Changes in the atmosphere, for example, of carbon dioxide can be buffered by absorption of the carbon dioxide into the oceans. That as you do that, you do change the acidity of the oceans. And we are finding that there's a measurable change in the acidity of the oceans.
And that is making it harder for the plankton to form their shells. And if there's a plankton die-off, that's the bottom of the food chain.
Plankton, as well as corals, are threatened not only by rising acidity, but by rising temperatures. Phytoplankton levels have declined by as much as a third in some northern oceans, and this has resulted in significant impacts to fish and krill and bird populations. But the reported dangers go far beyond a breaking of food chains, which is bad enough. Phytoplanktons produce half of the oxygen we breathe. Half. And they are a major carbon sink. When plankton dies, more carbon remains in the air, which means more warming. On top of this, new evidence shows that climate can shift very rapidly. Slow changes can build to a tipping point, and the system can then shift abruptly to a new state. This is happening in the oceans, where a global current known as the Grand Conveyor Belt is now being impacted with possibly disastrous results. As Douglas Crawford Brown, director of the Carolina Environmental Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told me,
the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting out into the atmosphere is rising to a point now where most scientists would agree that we may be at a sort of tipping point. We may be at a point where we're going to start to get so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that feedback mechanisms that control the temperature of the Earth will start to be stretched a little bit too far. The classic one is you get too much melting of ice, it flows into the ocean, and you shut off the conveyor belt. And if that happens, this will cause dramatic changes in the climate in England. I mean, England would literally become Norway or Sweden if you look at them on the globe if the conveyor belt were to be slowed down. Then we're starting to see changes of those magnitudes.
This is why I tend to use the term climate change rather than global warming. A warming planet can have heating and drought in some areas and freezing in others, such as Europe and North America would experience if the Gulf Stream shut down. The impact of that would be huge.
Those portions, much of which supply the agricultural bounty for Europe and the U.S., would have dramatic changes in climate, particularly affecting agriculture.
There are a number of self-reinforcing feedback loops now in operation. Here are two such processes.
You know, the polar ice melting, which is opening huge areas of sea in the polar regions without that ice, which normally reflects sunlight, that polar sea is now going to be absorbing a lot more sunlight and therefore heat.
We have a lot of carbon stored in the permafrost, and those permafrosts are starting to defrost, and when they defrost, that carbon dioxide, that carbon is going to be oxidized to carbon dioxide or brought out as methane and so on, and that will be a dramatic increase in greenhouse gases.
This may get out.
I think our scientists probably have jumped the gun a little bit and didn't really understand the whole picture here, and I'm not saying that I do, but it seems to me that what we've done is destroy our forests, which moderate our weather, keep it a little cooler in the summer, keep it a little warmer in the winter. And since we've destroyed so much of these giant forests all over, we're seeing the extremes in weather. We're seeing the unbelievable cold now and snow in the winter. And we're seeing also the tremendous heat in the summertime, extremes on both ends. I want to thank Nate and Eve for joining me this afternoon. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. And if we don't make it back this during the week, we'll try again next weekend. Thanks for listening, folks. Appreciate everybody that's been downloading the archive. Have a good day.